This is Economics for Entrepreneurs, the podcast where we apply the principles of economics to help you start, grow, and manage your business. Here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. Our goal at Economics for Entrepreneurs is to harness a deep understanding of economic science and its laws on behalf of entrepreneurs to help you make better decisions and to achieve greater business success. Today, we come to the subject of competition. On the surface, economists and entrepreneurs look at competition through different lenses. Economists love competition. They tell us that it makes the market efficient and sets up a rivalry for innovation and customer service in a competitive struggle to earn the customer's scarce and guardedly awarded dollar. Entrepreneurs? Well, perhaps not so much. Competition can feel like an obstacle, a challenge, a barrier to overcome to get to success. Sometimes it can feel even worse than that. Competitors can be viewed as enemies. Competitive strategy is a war game, a battle for market share, or an invasion of the competitor's territory or stronghold. There was a very popular book by Jack Reese and Al Trout called Marketing Warfare. Warfare is obviously the opposite of what economics is all about. To look on the other side of the coin, economists hate monopoly, because by smothering competition, monopolies can achieve the kind of pricing power that results in a lopsided trade, where consumers have to give up too much to acquire the monopolist's services compared to a freely competitive market. But entrepreneurs would love to be in a monopoly position. In fact, Peter Thiel, in his book Zero to One, says that any entrepreneurial business should strive to be a monopoly, to be unique in its offering, and so much better than any other business in that offering that it's not even close. So let's see if we can sort out the questions of competition and monopoly through the eyes of both the economist and the entrepreneur and arrive at some advice that's useful. We welcome back Per Bylund, a professor of economics who teaches entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University, a writer of books about firm-level economics where competition takes place, and he also writes a regular series of articles in Entrepreneur Magazine, and he thinks deeply about the subject we are discussing today. Per, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, thanks for coming back. We're talking about a very interesting subject today, which is competition. And we're going to be trying to see it through the eyes of the individual entrepreneur. So competition to the entrepreneur is an environmental or circumstantial factor, i.e. it exists. The entrepreneur's chosen task is to serve customers. We're trying to make them feel better. We're trying to persuade them to pay for one entrepreneur's service, ours. The customer gets to choose, not only between several suppliers of one service, even though those services may not be identical, they have the same benefit. But at the same time, they're also weighing another factor, which is they might want to buy multiple services. They might want to buy car repair and kitchen remodeling in the same week. So they're making a choice between competing offers like that, offers that compete for their spending dollar. So that's competition for the entrepreneur in real life, as we were saying before we got started. But let's start by defining competition as the economist sees it, and let's see if we can work our way to how the entrepreneur sees it.
Well, competition in most models would be competitions between producers or suppliers of commodities. So the good is already defined, right? And then it's really a matter of price. So it's a matter of the production function and minimizing the cost so that you can bid for consumers by selling at a lower price than someone else.
And when you say commodity, you mean not differentiated in quality. Is that the implication?
Exactly. So there's no differentiation in this model. But rather than looking at what competition is, I mean, an economist is trying to understand the efficiency of the economic system given whatever assumptions are of interest in the modeling exercise. So, I mean, if it's perfect competition, for instance, then you have numerous sellers and numerous buyers, and you're trying to figure out what the equilibrium point is. Or if it's imperfect competition, say an oligopoly situation or a duopoly perhaps, or even a monopoly, you have different numbers of sellers, basically, and that affects the competitive situation. But in general, these models start with the assumption that everybody has a gas station. I mean, what they're selling is identical. They can perhaps compete with locations a little bit and convenience in terms of where they're located with respect to customers and things like that. But it's really price that is the main means of competition.
And I think that's one place where economic theory risks losing people in terms of relating to real life. I remember from my Keynesian economic classes back in university that the whole idea of perfect competition, and perfect sounds like it means good, the best, but what they meant by it was every firm, like your gas stations, has equal knowledge and equal resources. There are no barriers to entry. The consumer has infinite choice, and the price of the service is competed down to the marginal profit product, and there's no profit. But nobody wants to be in that business. I know from just looking around here, I've got a choice of half a dozen gas stations. The prices are all different. And in one of them, I can redeem points from my local grocery store and get a further discount on the price of the gasoline, or I can stop right next to the freeway and easy on, easy off, which is a benefit. So there really is no such thing as perfect competition. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And I think actually that all economists agree as well, because I mean the perfect competition model, it really starts with the assumption of perfect information, which means everybody knows everything about everybody and at any time. Of course, there's no such thing. That would be sort of a competition between gods, and that is just completely unreal. But it serves a purpose, namely to figure out, okay, if we have a market that has only this product or maybe two different products, what could the price be? And I mean, efficiency for economists is really that there is no waste. Everything is used to create benefits for consumers. So there is no addition to the costs other than exactly what corresponds to consumer value. So there's no overhead that is not perfectly necessary or anything like that. And it's a good starting point for discussing the real world, if you want to compare sort of this utopian view of a completely perfect, in terms of efficiency anyway, economy, and then look at how the world differs. I'm not sure it's not helpful for entrepreneurs, and it's not relevant from a consumer point of view either. It's only relevant for sort of trying to engineer the system or manipulate the economy so that it works better and things like that. So it's really a starting point that facilitates sort of central planning, in a sense, figure out how things could be. But it's really an exercise in using one's imagination. So you're definitely right that it's not relevant for any real players in the economy, so to speak.
Okay, so I'm going to stay in economic theory for just one more point, if I may, and that is that there's more than one theory of entrepreneurship, and you and I favor the Austrian school. And Austrian economics sees entrepreneurship not so much as head-to-head competition and rivalry, but more as dynamic collaboration, in which at the system level, a competitive entrepreneur is looking for unique knowledge, unique skills, unique resources to try and meet a unique consumer need so that both parties can make a mutual beneficial trade. And profit is the signal of approval from the consumer that they prefer the entrepreneur's refined offering. So this seems like a place where we can favor Austrian economics because it's got a different theory. It's a collaboration theory, not a competition theory. People are exchanging information and everybody improves.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Austrian economics is really studying the economy as it is, not the economy as it potentially, given certain assumptions, could be like. So it's definitely a lot more relevant to anyone in the real world, so to speak, than these highly formalized economics models that we teach in undergraduate and graduate courses. And I would say that in the real world, as is the case also in Austrian economics, entrepreneurship is about positioning your offering with respect to what consumers value, and which seems sort of obvious, yet so many still fail to realize this fact. And we talked about value in a previous podcast, how important it is to realize what consumers actually want. What you talk about collaboration, that's again the economist's perspective, looking at the whole economy, the system, what is going on. Well, all entrepreneurs are collaborating in a sort of informal sense by figuring out how they can best satisfy consumers. And the best way to satisfy consumers is to provide a value that no one else has provided yet. To find your own niche, so to speak, and service consumers who have not been able to service those needs before. And of course, by doing that, you signal to other entrepreneurs that there is an opportunity here that others could be able to exploit in the same way or in a different way or in perhaps a better way. So, from the system point of view, it's definitely collaboration, but it doesn't have to be for this individual entrepreneur. For the individual entrepreneur, it's rather about figuring out how you can serve consumers to the best extent possible.
Well, great, Per. You've transitioned us to the real world. So thank you. So here we are as entrepreneurs. We want to be successful. We want revenue, which means, as you say, you start with the customer or the consumer. You figure out what is their need? How can I create value for them? But there will be competitors. Other entrepreneurs are competing for that consumer dollar. So I want to win. Is that the right language? I want to be better than my competitor at serving that consumer. I want to find a place where it's not about being better. It's unique. Nobody else can offer what I'm offering. What's the action that entrepreneurs have to take when they're thinking about real life competition?
Well, what they need to do is try to find a niche where they can service consumers in a sense that no one else has done before. It's about differentiation. You doing something unique, and I think you have Peter Thiel's book Zero to One in mind, right? Where if you can be innovative in the sense that you either create a new market or a new type of good or something like that, that also strikes a chord with consumers. What you are doing is really servicing them in a way that no one has done before, and then you will also be able to charge a pretty high price, or at least high relative to your costs, hopefully, so that you can make a lot of money off of it too. But the reason you make a lot of money doing this is because no one has satisfied these wants before. So you're doing something unique in how you satisfy consumers.
Yeah, and to your consumer-first theory, that means that I've got a better empathic understanding of their needs somehow. Maybe that comes out in execution, and maybe it comes out in innovation, but somehow I've divined a better understanding of what it is that consumers want. I was reminded of this the other day when somebody was talking about Pandora and saying, nobody knew that I could keep all my digital music in one place because there wasn't digital music until a few years ago. And nobody knew that I could create a DJ in the sky to play it for me in certain orders or arrangement. But that was a latent need that the consumer had, and the Pandora folks figured it out. Is that a good example?
I think so. I mean, it can be a new type of technology, sort of broadly understood. So you do something that no one has been able to do before, but it can also be a new type of communicating with consumers to tell them a story about what they can accomplish. Because very often consumers, they need a little help to understand and realize how useful a good or service actually is and what they can do with it. That's why in high tech, for instance, you talk about use cases and scenarios, and you try to tell a story around that. I mean, how can you use this gadget? Why is this gadget of extreme value in your everyday life as a consumer, whereas other gadgets are only useful, so to speak? And very often, it's not easy for consumers to see what they would, or it's not easy for them to imagine what they would want, because they don't understand the technology, they don't realize what is possible, they don't know the cost picture for entrepreneurs and so forth, or they don't realize what are the different uses for a good until someone shows you that. And I think it was Henry Ford who mentioned that if he was producing automobiles and he didn't ask consumers what they wanted, because he said if he asked consumers what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. And yeah. He realized that faster horses, well, first of all, those are really hard to produce, but also an automobile beats a faster horse. So he needed to tell a story to the consumers that maybe a horse is not the right way to go, right? Maybe there is an alternative for your transportation needs that is more reliable, faster, and whatnot else. And then offer them that product with the story.
Yep. Another consumer benefit that I think we've discovered how to provide and an area for competition now is in convenience and in specific areas of delivery. So the consumer always wanted convenience. You don't have to invent convenience. But now Amazon can deliver to my doorstep the next day, and Grubhub can bring me my food from local restaurants, or Uber Eats can bring me my food. And now you're competing for a consumer's time allocation. They don't have to go to the store, and so they can be doing something else. You've created a convenience benefit, knowing that convenience is always valuable. This is just a new type of convenience. So an entrepreneur doesn't always have to invent a benefit, just execute against it in a different way. Is that another way of competing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in a sense, anything that liberates a consumer is a value, right? So you liberate, in the beginning, you liberated consumers by offering them food because they were hungry and they were starving or something like that. But anything that makes them able to work less and have more leisure time and just enjoy themselves, that is a definite value. So we come to the point where we have so many goods and services available. I'm not saying that we have enough or that we should have less or anything like that. We can still innovate and get more goods that satisfy wants that we had no idea that we had. But we've gotten so far that what is important now is really time and to be able to use time for yourself and your family. I mean, that type of convenience that you're talking about. And it's also about privacy, about being able to just disconnect from the world for a little bit. That doesn't sound like it's a value, considering how we're nowadays, we're all looking at our smartphones 24/7 and everybody's sort of always chatting with someone. But that is a growing want among people to be able to just be for yourself a little bit. So that is perhaps the next big thing after convenience and after these deliveries to your house of all these goods that you previously you had to spend a lot of time and do the work yourself. Now you can just outsource that work on someone else.
Right. Another way of looking at that, I think, which can be useful is the obverse of creating value, which is looking at consumers today and asking what value are they being denied? What is it that they might want that they can't have? So convenience is a denied value when you don't have it, or privacy is a denied value when you don't have it. And as you say, you can liberate them from that denial of value. I like your line about liberating a consumer. So sometimes we can think by turning the telescope around and saying, what value are they being denied today?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, that's where entrepreneurship is sort of a good force in society too, right? That when what you are doing when you are delivering real value to consumers is that you are liberating them from whatever pains or hardships they are experiencing. It is definitely on their terms, like we talked about in a previous podcast. So you have to figure out who they are and what their lives are like and what they value as individuals, which might be unique, and then liberate them from anything that they feel that they have to do but cannot really avoid. If you can help them avoid that, then that's a definite value. It's about helping them to get away from whatever uneasiness they're feeling.
Right. So that's a very rich field of investigation for the entrepreneur. I want to move on to another element of competition, Per, and that is the other guy. What happens if I get out-competed? So we've discussed all these ways I can find uniqueness and I can serve the consumer, I can liberate them, but a rival comes along and targets the same consumer and maybe has better empathy or understands him better or offers a better value or a lower price, builds a stronger relationship, moves into a location where they're attracting more traffic than my gas station. So what does the entrepreneur do then in terms of reassessment or reestablishing their uniqueness? Is it leapfrogging and each one steals a march on the other each time, or is there a better way?
Well, it could be leapfrogging. I mean, in a sense, the two major things you can do is imitation or innovation. And innovation could be leapfrogging, just doing even more or even better what it is you're doing already. Or it could be differentiation too, that you find a specific niche where you have a market segment that the other guy who's now beating you has not discovered yet or is not servicing properly. And you realize that by targeting them specifically in a certain way because they want to hear a specific message or because they have a specific type of want or a type of life where they want it in a little different way. So, I mean, it is moving to uniqueness is often referred to as sort of monopolizing and becoming a monopolist. I mean, becoming a monopolist just means that you're the only one. There's nothing bad in being the only one. What it means, it could mean is simply that you're the first one to service consumers in this way, and no one else has figured that out yet. So I mean that's a great thing to do for you because it's potentially profitable, and for consumers who are serviced in a different way than they were before. I mean, if you're being outcompeted in what you are doing, you should do something differently. That's the simple answer to the question. It's not that simple in reality, of course. But I mean, what I would do is very often what the entrepreneurs do wrong is that it's that they're trying to cater to too large an audience. So they're sort of missing what makes subsets of this audience unique, which means that they're not satisfying people in the way that they could. They're not producing the the magnitude of value that they should be able to, and they probably should produce. So instead, I mean, sometimes you need to differentiate your product between market segments, even if there is no competitor, just to speak to different audiences on their terms, to figure out what they actually want. And you mentioned that before about being empathically accurate, to put yourself in the shoes of specific consumer groups or types of consumers, and figure out what type of message strikes a chord with them, and what type of product, how do I deliver it to those people, and so forth. People have very different interests, but we can still put them in groups or aggregates that have some common denominator and speak to them. But those groups cannot be too large, because then we're missing what's unique for subgroups.
So can I sum up your advice there as for entrepreneurs, that we should try and create a monopoly, which is defined as a very tightly identified target audience, not too big, a deep and hopefully unique empathic understanding of that audience, and a unique delivery of the service of the entrepreneur, which includes delivery, promotion, packaging, pricing, and all those other things. And I'm creating more value for the consumer that way. And so I'm doing my job as an entrepreneur by creating that monopoly. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I would say so. In all the respects that you mentioned, you are servicing the customer in better ways because of all those things. I mean, you can become a monopolist in a different way too, by simply using the political apparatus to raise barriers to entry for other entrepreneurs, which is not creating value for consumers. So both make you a monopolist, but only one is really a productive and value creative activity for consumers.
Good. We'll call it the Per Bylund value creating monopoly. That's our category. So
that's a nice ring to it. Yes.
That. So let's make one more step to competitive strategy, which may be a misnomer in the case of entrepreneurs. But I remember from my corporate days and my business school days that there is a conception of corporate strategy. At one time, there was a very sports-oriented kind of analogy to it. Another was, I remember it being called where to play and how to win, which is a kind of a big corporate way of looking at strategy. What industry or industry segment do I want to be in? And I want to be number one or number two in that business. So they talked about winning and winning plays and that kind of thing. I was reading something the other day that said, that's not strategy today. Strategy today is wait for the window to open and jump through it with all the resources you can to try and get a lead, which sounds a little bit opportunistic, but it was trying to recognize that windows do open from time to time. There are technology shifts, like the arrival of artificial intelligence today, or there's a structural change, like the shift of retailing to the internet. So tell us about competitive strategy as a tool for the entrepreneur. Is that relevant? Should entrepreneurs be thinking about it?
I think they should. But again, it goes back to really consumer value. I mean, most listeners might have heard of like Porter's five forces and methods like that, where you try to position your own offering in the market with respect to suppliers and customers and all of these other forces in the marketplace. But those are really about positioning in an industry that is sort of assumed to be non-changing in a fundamental sense. So it's really about getting market share, but it's not about being different or creating markets. And I mean, as an entrepreneur, what you should focus on is the value you're creating. not the good or service itself, but the actual value. And very often it could be the case that there is an existing industry where they get sort of close to satisfying consumers with the products they're producing, but then someone else invents some other device or a type of service, or has a different narrative, a different story that speaks better to these consumers and might satisfy the same want that they have, but that is only partially satisfied by these goods that are already offered, which means that this new type of good completely disrupts this existing market, because all of those what we call incumbent firms, those firms already existing and competing, misunderstood the customer in some fundamental sense, whereas this new entrepreneur understood the customer at least a little better, well enough to outcompete the whole industry. So many times a disruption that happens is really because you understand consumers a little better, or consumers might have changed a little bit because of all the offerings that are available. So it sounds almost philosophical, but what you should do is position yourself as well as possible with respect to your preferred target market's value. How can you produce as much value as possible? And where other entrepreneurs are, where potential competitors are, that's sort of secondary to that, because you need to create value to begin with. And if you create enough value, you are competing for consumers' dollars. I mean, let's be honest, that consumers do not have unlimited funds, which means anyone offering anything is really competing with each other for dollars.
Yep.
So this whole dividing it up in certain industries and so forth, that sort of goes back to what we talked about in the beginning with competing among commodity producers. Price is really important if you have a gas station. Then of course they add other layers and services to differentiate themselves a little bit. So they have food and snacks and stuff like that too. You are always really competing with the consumer's perception of what they can get now for their money and what they expect to be able to get for their money later on. So even if there could be a situation where even if you provide more value than everybody else in the marketplace, the consumer will still not buy from you, even if he or she recognizes the value of your offering, simply because that person expects to be able to get a better value tomorrow or next week or next year or whatever it is. So, in that sense, the positioning is all about the value, really.
So the constant change is upon us, and we always have to remember that. Just one more question about strategy that comes up, therefore, is in the corporate world, we used to, I can say, quote, do strategy. We used to make 5-year plans and do annual strategy reviews. And as you said, that was kind of divorced from management. You did management most of the year, but strategy once a year. And that may not be relevant to the entrepreneur. Bob Luddy, who was on the program recently, said that at his company, a very successful company, Captive Air, every once in a while, they would set a stretch goal. So if they hit $50 million, they'd say, how do we get to $100 million? And then they'd say, we don't know. And they try and figure out, as I think you're suggesting, creative ways to get there, how to create more value, how to reach more customers, how to expand the footprint of the company. And so there was no plan, in quotes, to reach that goal, but there was a creative urge because the goal had been set. As I listen to you, I think you're saying, hey, you do strategy every day, not even setting those goals. So just quickly, for our entrepreneurs who are listening, when should they do strategy? Is it something they're thinking about all the time? Do they need to set aside, as you say, I'm managing for the next 24 hours, but at some point I got to think about next year. How do they do that?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, it's about breaking even. Right? If you don't survive, there's no point in having a strategy, no matter how good or bad it is. But you should always aim for doing as much good as possible for your consumers. I mean, I don't see a problem at all with having a long-term goal, but those stretch goals or doubling your sales or whatever it is, those things, those are goals for your organization. Whereas what you should really focus on in order to create a lot of value for both yourself and the consumer is not necessarily introspective, but rather look at, okay, what can we do in the economy that is unique? What can we offer that no one else can offer? So it's back to the 0-to-1 type of reasoning and the sort of fundamental differentiation. How can we satisfy consumers in a way that no one else is satisfying consumers, or even better, that no one else can satisfy consumers? I mean, that's something that you should always think about and always think about possible ways of pivoting so that you can capture, in a sense, I really like that term, but capture a market that no one else has captured yet. So, I mean, thinking about it all the time is because you started out by saying that, well, it's a dynamic economy and it's sort of a learning process through competition and coordinative cooperation process. Well, that means that everybody's changing all the time, including consumers, and we're always learning more about ourselves and about society, about the economy and all of this stuff. So you can't really have a 10-year plan and follow it, because that's the only thing you can be sure of is that you're going to fail as a business. So what you need to do is always adjust and always think ahead a little bit and try to find a direction to where there is some value that has not been created yet. I mean, that's probably the best way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, just one final question on strategy. You teach in business school, and you can find, or I can find, various strategy tools on the internet, which are pretty available. One that used to be popular, I don't know whether it is now, is the SWOT tool, SWOT, which stands for Strengths and Weaknesses and Opportunities and Threats. And it was a 4-box matrix, I think. And strengths is kind of what are we good at? Weaknesses is the opposite of that. And then opportunities and threats were the external look at the market. What's out there that we could seize or capture, as you say? But what are the threats? Who's the competition that could take away from us? Are those kinds of formal tools useful in your opinion? And are there any others you've come across that you ever use?
In a sense, any such tool is helpful because it structures your thinking. So it makes sure that you don't miss anything. And I think that's what all these tools are really put together to do for you, right? There are plenty of these. I mean, I mentioned the Porter's Five Forces model before. And just like the SWOT, it sort of positions you or helps you position your business and your offering with respect to who else is out there in the economy. There's also the VRIN or the VRIO method, which really is about how can you produce something unique or have a unique resource in-house that no one can copy so that you can get a competitive advantage and hopefully a sustained competitive advantage. But those are all positioning within an industry. So, I mean, modern entrepreneurship education has a bunch of frameworks that are used for starting a business that are, I think, more useful than the strategy tools. And I'm thinking of things like Bill Ollett at MIT has Disciplined Entrepreneurship. You have Steve Blank's Lean Startup and things like that. And they help you identify what you're doing. And they both start with the consumer and what is the value you're creating and then how to create it. And I think that is a better way for startups, and it's a better way for incumbent businesses too, even really, really large firms. And we see that today. And a fascinating example would be Microsoft, a business that is huge, has been huge for a very long time, was never hip or cool in any sense. And they have completely renewed themselves because they're looking at, okay, who are our core customers? And they seem to have decided that is corporate, large businesses primarily, and to produce tools for them to conduct business in as smooth and a costless way as possible. Right? And today they're innovating a lot of stuff and trying to find their own niche. And that's by looking at what their real customers, the customers that they really know, which is not consumers for Microsoft, but corporations. And that way they have renewed themselves. And I think their reputation among consumers too is a much, much better now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. So I would look at any of those entrepreneurship frameworks that exist out there. And how to evaluate them? Well, anything that starts with consumer value would be very helpful.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up there, Per, but that's a great way to conclude this discussion about competition, which is, if I may paraphrase, and I'll leave you the last word to correct me if I get this wrong. If we follow your method, and I would say that's what we would call the Austrian method, which is based on consumer or customer sovereignty. You think of the consumer or customer first. You try to understand what value you can create for them based on their unmet needs, and you constantly refresh that value and make sure that you understand the consumer today and tomorrow, then really competition is not an issue for entrepreneurs. It's not the issue they should be thinking about strategically, because the consumer and the customer and the closeness of that connection and understanding, that's what they should be focusing on. So let me leave you to conclude.
Well, I think that puts it very nicely. And suddenly thinking of it this way allows us to understand what would probably be a paradox for someone using sort of the standard economics framework, that in most towns or cities, there are organizations or networks among entrepreneurs. And very often they meet at regular intervals and talk about their business problems and help each other solve those problems. I mean, why in the world would they do that if the only thing they're doing is competing in a sort of dog-eat-dog world, and they're only competing on price? So obviously there's something wrong with the model. And looking at it, instead trying to figure out what is the value for consumers and how can I do that the best way possible, then you're not really in a dog-eat-dog world. You're not competing head-on with others, but you're in a constant struggle with them to find where the real value is at. And they cooperate in solving problems and getting there, basically.
Well, it's a great and very positive way to end our discussion. Per, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Hunter.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out hunterhastings.com.